Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
You know, Rohit Arora and his company, Biz to Credit, where he's CEO, have for years had surveys that have proven to my satisfaction to be pretty prescient. He's here to talk about that, but also about the ways the government and other agencies have to help disaster victims. Rohit Arora, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First, tell us about your company, your website, and then a little bit about what you think is available for people hit by the twin disasters in Texas and Florida.
Yeah, so my company, Biz2Credit, the website is biz2credit.com. We are a marketplace where we help small and mid-sized businesses get access to capital, and we provide it through, large number of partners that we have, and we have been doing it for last 8 years now, and we are close to a $2 billion mark where we are, we have almost lent or facilitated lending of almost $2 billion as of now. In terms of, disaster loans, we did a lot of work here in the New York area after Hurricane Sandy, and the disaster loans, which are administered by SBA and also by FEMA, are actually a good source of funds for small businesses. Having said that, two big disclaimers there, or two big, challenges that we have faced in the past trying to help businesses get disaster loans is, one, the process is very slow still, because it's a government process. Banks typically are not involved in this. Most of the time it's handled directly by SBA and FEMA. So they don't have a lot of experience in actually processing these loans in a time-bound fashion. And the other thing most of the business owners need to remember is that you will be asked for a lot of paperwork. And that, I think, is a source of a lot of aggravation and frustration for most of the business owners, because, they have just gone through a big natural disaster. Their businesses are shut down, and then they're still expected to provide with tons of paperwork, for anything above $25,000. So up to $25,000, the process is still streamlined. Above $25,000, it requires a lot of paperwork. So I think business owners should be aware about that, and they have to, go through that process, which I think that's something that FEMA and SBA need to look into to improve that, stuff, because that's not a very good process for, handling disaster loans.
Well, Dan, I'm going to let you, since you're smack dab in the middle of that disaster area, I'll let you take over and ask some questions.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the show. Let's go back to your business. Would you consider yourself a fintech company?
Yeah, so we are a fintech company because what we have done really well is that, we have not only streamlined the process of getting loans, but we have also collect a lot of data. We have built scorecards. We have made it very easy both for business owners as well as for lenders to do eKYC. Like an example, a very good example is, we don't need bank statements from business owners. We don't need their tax returns or anything. We can get all that data with their authorization, from their banks or from IRS. So that streamlines the process. And then we have built scorecards to do scorecard-based lending, risk-based pricing, and also monitor the portfolio. So it reduces and removes a lot of friction by using technology and data analytics, and now we're also putting a lot of artificial intelligence into our platform to make the process even smoother and better, both for businesses as well as for the lending institutions.
But let's just take a moment for those who are listening today about what fintech lending, how it's different than going to a standard commercial bank. So just take a moment and help our listeners who may not be aware of what you do, what a fintech lender, how he's different, how it's different than a bank.
Yeah, so I think there are three big fundamental differences between a fintech player and a bank. So the first big difference is that as a bank, you know, their all their time, effort, and energy, even if they put out an online form, is to bring you into a branch. And even if you're looking for a loan product, they try to sell you every other product except for a loan product first, so including deposit, including, you know, everything else. So I think that's a big difference in experience, that with a fintech player, you don't have to go anywhere. You can do things online. The second big difference is in the amount of paperwork. So typically in a bank, you know, even if you go into a branch and even if you're an existing customer of the bank, you are still expected to provide with tremendous amount of paperwork, including your tax returns, your bank statements, and your company documentation. Even if you are a big deposit customer with that bank, you know, they don't use that information really well today. Unlike fintech players who will, you know, sync up with your bank accounts, they will sync up with IRS, they will sync up with your payroll accounts and your payment accounts, and with your authorization, they can get all the information and data. And the third aspect is speed and clarity. So with fintech players like Best2Credit, you know, you can get a decision within 24 to 48 hours, and you can expect the money to come in, within 72 hours. With banks, you know, just the decisioning process can take 2 to 3 weeks' time, while the actual disbursement of funds can take another 2 or 3 weeks. So I think those are the key fundamental differences. Having said that, obviously banks still provide money at a lower cost, lower interest, if they approve. Their approval rates are much lower than fintech players, and they will provide you with longer terms, because that's what fintech players are not able to provide today. You know.
So you're saying that fintech lenders don't offer similar duration of loan terms. Is there a maximum that a fintech lender will go out?
See, typically, fintech players have two kind of offerings. So like a player like Best2Credit, we also offer bank products. So in case if these are bank products, you know, then obviously this comes at a bank pricing, so there's no difference in that, so we can go up to 10 years. But predominantly, even in this day and age, you know, banks have been very slow to adapt to the technology. So most of the, or a large number of products that the fintech players like us provide are non-bank products, so which are shorter terms, like up to 2 or 3 year terms, compared to bank terms, which are like between, you know, 3 to 5 year kind of stuff.
Okay. Dollar amounts that you can get with a fintech lender?
So that is something I think which, you know, when initially players like us started, we were small and we were only offering dollar amounts up to $200,000 or $250,000. You know, over the years we have expanded on working capital. Now we can go up to $1.5 million. On commercial real estate, we can go up to $5 million. So that is one place where the gap is starting to get bridged pretty quickly. Because as the fintech players have matured, as they have more data, as they have, you know, bigger, financial strength. So from a dollar aspect, you know, that gap is bridging pretty quickly, actually.
Do you find that a fintech lender may be willing to take more risk than a bank?
Fintech players typically can take more risk, absolutely, because of, you know, few reasons. One is that, you know, they have a higher tolerance for risk because they source money from, non-bank investors, you know, who are looking for a higher yield, but also they can tolerate higher risk. The second thing is that, you know, with the new way of doing underwriting and having more data, you know, that they can, you know, look at it in an automated fashion. So they can also, you know, price that risk better, so they can do better risk-based pricing. And the third thing is, especially for smaller loans, so typically when businesses which are very young are more risky, and that's where, you know, the fintech players do better, because, you know, with all the technology that they have built, so for a lot of banks even today, if they're trying to process a loan of 100,000 or less, it's very expensive to do that in a manual fashion. And with the fintech players, you know, they become pretty good at that. And typically those loans are requested by younger businesses which traditionally have a higher risk of failure than compared to more well-established businesses. So from that aspect, I would say they have a greater appetite for risk, and they have a better understanding of risk-based pricing also.
And so what would typically be the rate difference between on a 5-year loan between you and a traditional bank?
Typically, a 5-year loan at a traditional bank will come anywhere between 7 to 9% right now, 6.5 to 9, depending on where they peg it to the prime. With most of the fintech players, those rates start at 9 or 10% and can go up to 24-25% kind of stuff. Or with some other players, it can get even higher, but that's the average that we have seen in the market.
And what is your typical, right now, your typical loan size?
So typical loan size is, 100,000 plus right now on the working capital side, and we also offer commercial real estate bridge loans, which is around $1 million, on that in the marketplace.
Don, anything from you?
I was going to jump in, but you were doing such a good job of getting such an interplay with the two of you. But I'd like to go to your latest survey, Rohit, because in it you said that you found that national banks were finally opening the spigot a little bit for small business.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I think we have been doing the lending index for last now, 6 years, and this is almost the highest that the the big banks have reached in terms of their approval rates. We are seeing it's still very slow, but we are seeing more appetite among larger or big banks or national banks to do more small business lending now than any time in last 6 to 7 years, and there are a few reasons behind it. One obviously is that the economy is pretty stable. Most of these small businesses are in good financial health. So typically banks look at last 3 years of their financials, and they're looking pretty good compared to the prior 3 years when the recession was still there. The second thing that is happening is that business owners are also feeling more bullish because of a stable economy. They are starting to invest more money in capital improvements and beefing up their businesses. So there's a greater need for capital from more well-established businesses, which traditionally big banks cater to. They don't cater to businesses which are less than 2 or 3 years in business. And the third thing which is also happening is that the big banks are starting to use technology finally. Still baby steps, but they're starting to use that. Compared to smaller banks, smaller banks are behind the curve on that. So by starting using the technology, they can, they're experimenting more with smaller loans, and that is something also boosting up their approval rates right now.
Well, one more question before our break. Several big banks have bought fintech companies to get into this business. Does that scare you, or does that mean that small businesses will have a better options?
I would say what's going to happen over the next 12 to 18 months are, there will be a lot of convergence between the fintech players and banks. Till 2 years or 3 years back, banks thought that fintech players are just, just will fade with time, but that didn't happen. I think last year it was more like, are we going to be competitors? I think there are two distinct trends which are happening. One, obviously, more fintech players and banks are going to work more closely, either by acquisition or partnerships. And the other big trend which is happening is that the larger of the fintech players have started applying for industrial bank licenses. Now, that's going to be very interesting, because once these fintech players get industrial bank license, their cost of money, that's one thing that is still a differential cost of money between fintech players and with the banks. Now, once that starts going away, the banks will face tremendous amount of competition, especially the smaller and the mid-sized banks who don't have a balance sheet strength to acquire either these fintech players or spend a lot of money on technology. And we will see a lot of consolidation in the banking industry over the next 5 to 7 years, because that industry is totally ripe for a massive consolidation in this country. Part of it will be driven by technology, and a part of it will be driven by the fact that some of the fintech players, as they get the industrial bank licenses, they themselves will become bank-like players, but with a pretty extensive and savvy technology phase, you know, upfront.
We have to stop a moment here and for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
At Valero, we believe life gets lived between every fill-up. So whether you go down the road on two wheels or four, whether your Wednesday night is spent racing to the grocery store or down a track, and whether you're dropping off the mail, the pizza, the kids, or all of the above, we're here to make sure you're never running on empty. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're here with Rohit Arora. He's a CEO of Biz to Credit. Rohit, give us your website once again before Dan asks the next question.
Yeah, so our website can be accessed at www.biz2credit.com.
Well, now, Dan, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Rohit, I want to go back to where you were finishing it before the break, because you said something that was very interesting to me, and that was some of the fintech lenders are applying for industrial banks. And I'm curious as to if the business model was working as a fintech lender, why would you go and want to become an industrial bank?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good question. I think the one challenge which the fintech players have been facing across the board is that, you know, at the end of the day, any fintech player is a fintech player because they have a lending piece in that. So it's not just a technology, pure play technology play. And that's where, you know, the growth gets restricted by the fact that the cost of capital is higher and there is lack of permanent capital, because most of the capital comes from third parties and that could be a little speculative at times. So the idea of taking industrial bank licenses is that as an industrial bank, you're not as heavily regulated as a normal deposit-taking bank. And so, and at the same point of time, can you use technology and can you, you know, use the lower cost of capital to grow the business faster? And this is not surprising, because if you see every other industry today, if you see retail, you know, online and offline was considered two different businesses. But now what's happening because of Amazon, now Walmart and Target and everybody is almost co-mingling their online and offline business. And same thing is going to happen in the financial services space. Some of the banks will try to become fintech players, and some of the fintech players will try to become banks. And what both sides are trying to figure out is that what is the best business model? Because I don't think the fintech players, most of them, have still a very stable business model. Just by, you know, lending money through technology, if they don't have access to permanent capital, that's not a very sustainable business model over long term, you know, for them.
So how do they get sustained capital by switching from a fintech company to an industrial bank? Are they out collecting deposits from individuals to try and build that, or do they get equity investors? How does that? I'm still trying to figure out what the advantage. You seem to think that industrial banks provide more stable capital, and I'm trying to figure out how.
Yeah. So that's a very good question. So the way the industrial banks provide more stable capital is obviously equity. You can raise more equity in that. The other thing that you can do, like what Goldman is doing, is that, you know, they're offering CDs. So as an industrial bank, you can offer CDs, you know, which are not treated as onerous from a regulatory aspect as normal deposits. And you can offer those CDs to, you know, business owners or high net worth individuals. And, you know, even if you're paying a little higher interest rate, you know, that gets compensated by the fact that your overall cost of doing business is lower compared to, you know, a traditional bank, which has a lot of branches and a lot of overhead and a lot of staff and old technology. So that's how, you know, they're looking at, you know, doing it. The second thing is that once you become an industrial bank, you also can start getting warehouse lines, which are cheaper than compared to, you know, if you are just being a fintech player. So the benefit of that is that, you know, still the cost of money will still be higher than a normal deposit-taking bank, but it will be much lower than a traditional fintech player, which has, you know, which is either having warehouse lines or sourcing capital from other sources. And at the same point of time, you know, you can also leverage, you know, the securitization market better. as an industrial bank, and you can also, you know, look at raising wholesale deposits in the market, where you can again use the technology to do that, and that will, you know, be less onerous from a regulatory aspect, but the cost of capital will be lower, and you will have access to more permanent capital.
So with the industrial bank offering certificates of deposit or equity in the bank, in essence, if I understand what you're saying correctly, the industrial bank is the online version of a fintech lender who's trying to be a bank but doesn't really want to be a bank. I mean, I don't see the industrial bank operating branches, do you?
No. So it will be a certificate of deposit for raising deposits. So a very good example prior to the recession was, I would say, ING Direct. So ING Direct used to get all the deposits online, and then they used to deploy all that money into mortgages. And basically that's how they were, you know, able to pay a higher, you know, APR to their customer base, and at the same point of time, you know, used to deploy the money in mortgages. So here the idea is that, you know, these industrial banks will be able to raise certificate of deposits, let's say 2-year, 3-year, 5-year deposits at a higher APR than what the traditional banks provide. No branches offline, no offline staff, and then use that money to lend the money out and make a yield spread out of it. And that way, you know, they can, you know, benefit from lower cost of capital, but at the same point of time, they also get benefited by the fact that, you know, all their borrowers are also online, and they have very little, you know, fixed expenses in terms of branch networks and staffs, which is distributed across the region.
So that would these be large dollar amount deposit CDs as opposed to, you know, 10 or 20,000?
No, these could be both. These could be smaller to larger. The only thing is that, you know, in certain cases, the industrial banks have an opportunity or the ability to give the FDIC insurance. In that case, they will be regulated more, but still less regulation than if you have a full branch network. And in a lot of cases, they will offer that without providing the FDIC guarantee on it. You know?
So they would not be subject to federal banking regulations if they don't offer FDIC?
Yes. So they are subjected to some of the federal banking regulation, but it's a very light-touch regulation compared to the fact that if you are providing FDIC-insured deposit, because then the regulation goes up quite a bit, you know.
So are there fintech lenders that have acquired industrial,
so
or created
industrial
banks?
Few of them have applied for the industrial bank license. I think the rest of the industry is looking at it. So guys like Square, SoFi, you know, they have already applied for an industrial bank license, and they're going through the process. OCC is also looking at it, because one of the things that OCC has brought out is a draft, you know, regulation, which obviously still hasn't got approved, but the draft regulation is an ability for fintech players to get a national banking charter as an industrial bank without having to go from state to state approvals, and also less regulatory you know, burden on those players compared to traditional banks.
So let's go back to our listener. Let's go back to our listener real quick. If they had money, if an industrial bank was available today, what might the difference be in yield on the deposit for our customers?
So typically, you know, if you go to a bank and you want to deposit money today, you will get anywhere from 0.5 to, you know, 0.8, maximum 1%. Industrial banks are providing anywhere between 1.25 to 1.5%, you know, depending, and also if the term is longer, then that can go up to almost, you know, around 1.8 to 2% also, you know. Right.
Wow. Don, back to you.
Well, all I can say is thank you, Rohit Arora, for being with us today, because we've run out of time, but it's been illuminating. Your website again and how people can reach you?
Yeah, so our website is biz2credit.com, and they can also call on our toll-free number. That's 800-200-5678. And right now, you know, we are trying to support a lot of businesses in Florida and in the Texas area who have been hit by hurricane. So if anybody has any, you know, if they need any help, they can call our toll-free number 800-200-5678, and we can try to help them.
Thank you so much.
Now a word from our sponsor before our next guest, which I'm sure will be really fascinating.
Life. It's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full. Full of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late-night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. Small business funding is easier these days thanks to a new breed of lender called FinTech lenders. These internet-based lenders cut the time between applying for funds and getting the funds to just hours instead of months. They also make it easier to repay your loans, but their costs might be a little higher for their service. The next time you need dollars for your small business, try them. You might like the change. I'm Dan Perkins for Recalculating.biz and your small business tip of the day.
Well, Dan, our next guest is very important to many of our over-the-air marketplace radio station listeners, where legal recreational marijuana sales are booming. Our next guest, Socrates Rosenfeld, is the founder and head of Jane. It's a website that you have to look at. I urge our audience to listen to. I will let him explain what Jane does for legal marijuana buyers. Socrates, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be on.
Okay. Socrates, tell us what your website does for our listeners.
Sure. So our website is iheartjane.com, and we are the cannabis industry's first and only online marketplace. So if you think about really what and how you order online for just about every other product, if you think about when you go on Amazon, you type in exactly what you want and Amazon brings it to you. If you go on Netflix and you're looking for that documentary, you type in exactly what you want, and now Netflix brings that to you. And in the cannabis industry, that shopping experience wasn't yet available due to different complications like regulations and the ability for the dispensary, so on and so forth. And so what we've done is we've created a shopping experience that replicates an Amazon or Netflix when you're shopping online for your cannabis. But really, the interesting part about what we do is that we actually push business to the small businesses and the dispensaries that have a footprint in the community rather than pulling business away. And we do that by some very sophisticated technology where we plug directly into the point of sale systems at the dispensary, and then we create a turnkey digital storefront for these small businesses that connect the products on their store shelves to customers in the area searching for those products.
Dan, I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to let you go first.
Thank you. Interesting idea. So let me see if I've got it right. I live in a legal state like New Jersey, and Don sits on the board of a legal nonprofit dispensary. You can go to Don's dispensary, create an online presence specifically for New Jersey, for his dispensary. And then if people come to your website and they're looking for medical marijuana in the state of New Jersey, you will then forward them or take them to Don's online storefront, and they can make a sale directly to the customer?
Exactly. And there are some key – you hit the nail right on the head, Dan. There are some key things I'd like to highlight. One is that, you know, these dispensary owners, like in this hypothetical situation where Don is the dispensary owner, they're small business owners. And so I'm sure you talk to a lot of retail owners who are focused on inventory, they're focused on scheduling, they're focused on really serving the customer. And the last thing they need to focus on is updating a website. It creates, you know, buggy, they got to update code, they have to do all these things. And so what we do is, at no work to Don, all Don has to worry about is keeping his inventory up to date, and we take care of the e-commerce for him. The second thing that I'd like to highlight is for the customer. So you mentioned how you just search for a certain product and you can find it real instantly. That's a novel idea in the cannabis industry. For listeners who aren't really familiar with the cannabis product in the industry, there are, right now on our marketplace, there are over 10,000 products, meaning there are teas and lotions and bath salts in addition to the flower and the concentrates. So finding exactly what you want is critical, especially for those medicinal patients who are looking to address symptoms like pain or sleep or things like that. So the ability to just not only type in a product that you want or a brand that you want, but now you can go on and say, hey, I need pain relief, or I need some help sleeping, or I need to mitigate my hunger or increase my hunger for some medical patients. Now they can just go on there, type those keywords, and if they're in New Jersey and we're supporting stores in New Jersey, they're going to be connected to the stores carrying exactly the product that they want and need.
Well, so Dan, let me jump in here. Right now, Socrates' website is very good for recreational. Be very difficult for us, but because for several reasons. But I've already introduced him to our board because I feel that what he's doing, he's ahead of the crowd on it. But right now, can your consumers order the to make sure that the product is there when they get there, Socrates?
That's exactly right. Yes. And so just to be clear, to answer your question directly, yes. Similar to how if you know a company like Starbucks, they have their app, right? And the big pain in the butt for Starbucks customers is before work, no one wants to wait in line for their caramel macchiato. So now Starbucks thought, hey, what if for those busy customers, they could reserve exactly what they want. They come in, they skip the line, they say, hey, I'm Socrates, I'm here for my caramel macchiato. They give it to me, and I'm gone. That's exactly the same situation and shopping experience that our customers experience on iHeartJane. And that's really powerful for us because a lot of people maybe don't want to go into the dispensary and spend time there. Maybe they are afraid to ask a quote-unquote dumb question. Here, now they're provided the opportunity to discover, educate themselves, find exactly what they want, and then they go into the dispensary. There's no hassle, there's no waiting, and then dispensaries love it because now they can connect with their customers, learn about really what they want, and so they can better serve their community. And then really the second point is, that's a beautiful part about being technology, is the fact that we can be very adaptable. I don't really see the cannabis industry right now as one national industry. I see it more as kind of 50 little different distinct state markets. And so as an online marketplace that's trying to aggregate and create a shopping experience like an Amazon, it's very tricky. So just to be clear, we can now plug into any dispensary, whether they do brick and mortar, in-store pickup, whether they also want to do delivery, whether they're in a recreational market like Denver, or if they're in a medicinal market like New Jersey. We work with any and all dispensaries across the United States.
I have a follow-up question.
Please.
Very important. Very, very. To me, it seems like a very important question.
Yeah.
That is that the conflict between federal and state laws over the distribution of marijuana products are clearly distinct. They've got 27 states, I believe, who have approved it for medical purposes, a handful that have added recreational. But one of the restrictions that I'm aware of, and I'm curious how you deal with it, is that if Don's dispensary were to send me product in Florida, he would be in violation of the federal statute, and he would be in jail in a heartbeat. How 100%. Do you control and make sure that or maybe the better way to say it, who's responsible for for verifying the residency for the purposes of shipment to make sure that the dispensary doesn't get into trouble?
That's a great question, Dan. So first and foremost, we do not aid in the shipping of product. There are some mail order dispensaries out there who focus on that for patients who are restricted, like they're in senior homes, they don't have access to dispensaries, so they get mail order stuff. We do not do that. So really, it's on the dispensary's responsibility, and we make it actually very easy for the dispensary to validate that patient. So when you go into a dispensary, you have to show an ID. For medicinal markets, you have to show a medical marijuana card and recommendation from a doctor. All that stuff now is digitized on our platform. So as a customer, you upload those necessary documents, and now as the dispensary, they have the responsibility, as they should and as they most definitely want, to validate that customer before they ever go and proceed with fulfilling that reservation. And then on the flip side to that, Dan, if you're the customer, you're getting real-time updates, similar to how you order a Domino's pizza or your Uber. Now, when you order your cannabis on iHeartJane, you're getting real-time updates in terms of, okay, Don is now preparing your items. Now your items are ready for pickup. And then if you're in New Jersey, you drive to that dispensary, you show your ID, they say, yep, you are who you say you are. You go in, you skip the line, and you pick up your products, and it's there waiting for you at the time that you wanted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was curious about in the areas you indicated there were some areas where, or some patients who can't get out for whatever reason, and that there is a mail order business. But they have the same restrictions as relates to mail order of complying with the federal statute. So they have to be careful, I would assume, too.
Of course, and they are very focused on complying with those state regulations, and that's what they really – that's what they focus on. There'll be a kind of a mail order only direct to usually senior citizens who are looking for tinctures and things like that who can't get out and go to a dispensary. Yeah, and just to be clear, that those mail order services are actually just for in-state. So to your so it's not like you can ship from New Jersey down to Florida. In California, you would have to ship within California state.
Okay. Don, do we have time or we got to go to a break?
I'll keep going. You're doing a good job.
Okay. I try. So I want you to look in your crystal ball.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is preeminent in everybody's mind in the cannabis industry is what is the Attorney General going to do about enforcement? There's some rumblings that he's looking at recreational differently than he's looking at medical. So, there are people who are concerned that Congress is not ready to legalize cannabis on a national basis. What do you see happening in the regulatory environment over the next couple of years in marijuana?
That's a great question and something that we obviously talk about a lot. First and foremost,
everybody does.
I know. First and foremost, I think with the issue what Jeff Sessions and the current administration present is actually it's almost a blessing in disguise, and I know I might get flack for this. But what it has done, it has forced state leaders to actually take a stand and defend the needs and wants of their constituency. So now what you're seeing is states like Colorado, California, Washington, who see the benefits of a well-run, operated, legitimate, legal state cannabis industry with all this tax revenue coming in, now they're really taking a stand to defend that and say, hey, let's have a real conversation about this and let's do this right because this is really beneficial for our state and our citizens of California, et cetera. So that's actually been a blessing in disguise that now we're actually having professional, real conversations looking at policy, seeing how we can structure it and do it the right way. So as a tech company, when we're watching this, it's, you know, we're in a decent spot because we can adapt very easily. If recreational doesn't go, we can still focus on net. If delivery is not allowed, we can still focus on brick and mortar in-store pickup. Where I see this going is you have some very pivotal state markets going, one of which is California, where we currently sit in our headquarters in Santa Cruz. There's a lot of money coming in this state, and it's coming from a legal cannabis market. Legal sales of cannabis in the last quarter alone in California, $900 million. That's a lot of money that can be taxed and distributed across the state. So I think what you'll see happen is the first conversation will be, where are we going to put this money? And that will drive regulation around banking. And then after that, I think once we can figure out the banking part and figure out a way to protect people trying to do the right thing in this industry, tax it the right way, then I think the dominoes will fall. But we're very excited. There's over, you know, about 31 states that have a legitimate medical program. 9 states are recreational, and that number is continuing to grow. If you last polls, it's like something astronomical, like 94% of all U.S. Citizens want some form of national medicinal cannabis to be legal. So we think the conversation's there. It's now at an item, a topic that presidential candidates are going to be talking about. It's a huge topic of conversation for the young millennial generation now entering the workforce. And so I think we're just going to continue to move things forward. And as iHeartJane, if we could play a small role in, we all want the same things. We all want to keep it out of the black market. We all want to keep it out of children. We all want some testing and some research done on this. And so we're collecting a lot of great data, and we're trying to legitimize the shopping experience and support small business owners who are trying to do the right thing and help their community. And we're really excited about the future for that.
Well, Socrates, we have to take a break right now for word from our sponsors, but we'll be right back.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
We're back here with Socrates Rosenfeld, whose website, Jane, helps people in states with legal recreational marijuana to find it easier and perhaps pay it a little less. Dan, I want to jump in here with a couple of questions. First one is totally off the subject. Socrates Rosenfeld, what a combination. How did you get that?
I had a very optimistic mother who named me Socrates, who had high hopes for her oldest son. But if you really want to get into it, my name is kind of indicative of my multi-ethnic heritage of obviously Greek. I have some Egyptian, Indonesian, Armenian. So it's kind of all over the place. A strong Jewish last name with a strong Greek first name. You can't forget it, which is not always a bad thing, but I used to be in the Army, and they would remember my name all the time, and sometimes that's not always the best thing. But it's a solid name, that's for sure.
You're a graduate of MIT, if I recall correctly. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to the point that you're at now.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually graduated from West Point for my undergrad in 2004. I grew up in a little town outside of Boston called Newton, Massachusetts. I went to West Point. I graduated by the skin of my teeth, as they say. And then I was commissioned as a second lieutenant and entered the Army for 7 years as an Apache helicopter pilot. I deployed to Korea. I commanded a company in Baghdad, Iraq. And it was some of the best times and some of the scariest times of my life in my 20s. I actually had never consumed cannabis a day in my life. And I got out of the military in 2011. I was 29 years old. I had really no idea what I wanted to do. And like most veterans or most anybody coming out of a significant transition, I got kind of stuck in the off-tempo and the cadence of life of a high-intensity, kinetic job like an Apache helicopter pilot. Here I was as a civilian in Boston. I couldn't really slow down. And for me, cannabis, my wife actually presented the opportunity and said, hey, maybe you should try this and see if this works for you. And I did, and it changed my life. It brought me a sense of well-being and balance, homeostasis that they say that I really couldn't find anywhere else. It wasn't happening for me with working out. I used to dip Copenhagen. It was gross. I tried drinking. It didn't work. And for me, cannabis allowed me to connect to my loved ones, connect to myself, and really turn the page and allow myself to enter in the civilian world. So from there, I had a huge passion and interest in cannabis, except I was a business school student at MIT. And so during the day, I would be learning about entrepreneurship and technology. And at night, I'm kind of on my own studying about cannabis. And I dreamed of the day that these two worlds could come together. And I came out to California with that dream in mind. And it's been a blessing that I was able to see that to fruition. So the real issue for me was, as a patient and a new patient, you know, I couldn't find what I really wanted and what was working for me. And that was the genesis behind Jane. So now it's our charge to ourselves and our responsibility for medicinal patients as well as recreational patients to find exactly what they want and do so in a safe, secure, simple manner.
Well, Socrates, where is your operation based?
We are headquartered in Santa Cruz, California. We have teams in the Bay Area, Denver, Boston, actually, and we're expanding. So it's a lot of fun. We have a very dispersed team, but it brings me back actually to my Army days about having different units scattered across the globe and managing that. And it's been an honor to work with such a fine team that can be so autonomous and drive things forward in their own respective markets.
Well, where are you based?
Santa Cruz. I like to surf. Yeah, I like to surf way too much that I can't stray too far from the beach.
Well, frankly, after this program, I want to talk to you about our board, but I'm going to turn it back over to Dan because I'm sure he has a couple of more questions.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Socrates. I am also working in the area of helping dispensaries deal with the restrictions on using banks to manage cash. But I want to make an observation and then get your reaction to it. We have talked to people in Ohio and Florida and even in Colorado, Massachusetts, what we're hearing is that the oversight boards that are responsible for this business are people who have no idea what's going on in the industry or have any experience in understanding what cannabis truly is. And they're making regulations which, for lack of a better description, seem to me to be absurd. You know, if Don had at his dispensary, as people in a nursing home, the state of New Jersey says, well, the nursing home shuttle bus cannot bring patients to Don's dispensary. They can't walk there. They don't have a car. But, you know, and I could go on and on and on about ridiculous rules about the growing of it, the dispersing of it. It seems to me that the government oversight is so far behind the realities of what's going on in the marketplace. In many cases, it seems as if they're trying to restrict the implementation.
Mm.
Any thoughts there?
Yes. So I think at a philosophical level, people are afraid about which they do not know, or they know very little. So if I am trying to put myself in the regulator's shoes, if all I've heard is bad boogeyman stuff about cannabis, and now I'm charged with the responsibility of creating regulation around it, and I know very little of it, obviously I'm going to be a lot more conservative, and that doesn't help things out. It's inefficient. Now, we are at a, in my opinion, once-in-a-generation opportunity as entrepreneurs, as civilians, as business owners, where we are taking this billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry that already exists from the darkness, as they say, into the light. And so we find ourselves in this transition period. So we look at it as, and you are not mistaken, there are regulations across the country that, and you could say this about really any industry, not just cannabis, but there's always that tension between business owners trying to innovate and maybe regulators trying to take care of, you know, the constituency. But really, as we see ourselves, and I can only speak to myself, we see this as an opportunity to have a voice in this discussion where really, you're right, elected officials are just kind of getting on board and realizing, okay, we have to really talk about this. And we want to have a seat at the table at Jane. We really want to provide some legitimate data. We really want to enable business owners to do the right thing. And from a technology standpoint, we make it quite easy for dispensaries. Like we said, they're retail owners, right? They're retailers. So they have 1,000 different things to worry about. At least with their e-commerce, we can take care of that and help them. And then when the goal is in the future, as we continue to grow, which we are, we'll have a larger and larger voice to then educate regulators about creating policy and regulation that makes sense around actionable data and real business happenings rather than some theoretical speculation.
Socrates, do you see a time like Canada and the UK and other countries where the federal government will in fact approve sale of cannabis nationwide?
Absolutely. Without question. I don't know how long, and I don't know how we'll get there, but I've talked to way too many veterans. I've talked to way too many patients who, you know, this product saved their lives. I read something today. Someone will die of heroin. Someone will die of opioids today. Someone will die of meth today. And someone will have been saved because they experienced cannabis for the very first time. I was one of those people. And so in my opinion, this is why I've committed my life and my team has devoted their lives to allowing and pushing this movement forward, because this is a special plant and product that helps people. And I think it only serves the American people, and Americans are smart enough to understand, hey, if this helps people, and let's do this the right way, and let's do it the American way, and we hope we're part of that process.
Don, back to you.
I don't know. After that that impassioned statement, it's difficult. I had to clear my throat. But Socrates, tell us your website again and how people can reach you.
Sure. Our website is www.iheartjane.com. And they can reach us at info@iheartjane.com, or they can even email me direct at soc@iheartjane.com.
Well, we've been talking with Socrates Rosenfeld, who's got a terrific idea and who has some very good ideas behind it. Dan, one final question and one quick answer.
That's a tough for either one of us. do you think that the industry, as you know it now, has a responsibility to their constituents to do more research on justifying all the claims that are being made about cannabis?
The answer is yes. And the follow-up to that is there. I know so many people within the industry, Dr. Sue Sisley, who's trying to push that initiative to say, hey, we're all trying to figure out what the real scientific facts are behind this product. Let's go and test this so that we can create some good policy around it.
Well, on that note, we have to say goodbye to Socrates for what I consider one of our better half hours. Thank you so much.
Guys. Thank you, gentlemen.
Before you hear this or this or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at valerocleangas.com.
Dan Perkins here from recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. Should I grow my business or stay the size that I am? One of the most difficult decisions about a small business is, should I try to grow it? And if I want to grow, what is the best way to do it? If you look at the internet, you can find lots of advice on how to expand your business. So here's your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. Go to the sba.gov website and you'll find 10 ideas of how to grow your business. They're not in order of importance, they're just 10 ideas. Some may be more suitable, others may not, for you and your business. The one that struck me was add another store. My brother-in-law started with one pizza shop, and over the last 15 years, he's grown to 5. You may not have a storefront, but a service business. So look at your competitors and see if they might be willing to sell or merge with you. This has been Dan Perkins with your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Well, Dan, we're back. We've had two very interesting guests. So what do you think?
I think that I enjoyed talking to both of them. Two dramatically different businesses and services. But I want to remind our guests that we have these quality types of guests all the time. And so if you go to our website, recalculating.biz, you can hear past shows, including this one. And we'll hope you listen to them and grow in knowledge about how to be a better entrepreneur and more successful. Don?
Well, I agree with you at that point. I sit on the medical marijuana board, and we're facing the fact that New Jersey may go to recreational. But the real interesting point was that the federal government, the Congress, just extended the rule exempting medical marijuana companies that President Obama had put in place only until December. They refused to extend it into the new year, and that was at the behest of Attorney General Sessions. So everybody is looking for what's going to happen in the next 3 months on the issue of the protections given by President Obama in his administration, whether they will continue under President Trump. It's going to be an interesting time.
Sounds like it.
Well, Dan, it's time to say goodbye.
Well, thank you for joining us, and join us next week with Don and me on recalculating.biz.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.